Combat Search and Rescue, or CSAR, is a vital mission of the United States Air Force. After somewhat disappointing performance in Operation Desert Storm, the combat rescue community has been essential in the wars in the Balkans in the 1990s and the global war on terror over the last two decades. Combat rescue forces routinely put themselves in danger to rescue Americans, coalition partners, civilians, and even injured enemy combatants. The mission set is exemplified by their motto, "These things we do that others may live." My guest this episode is one of the thought leaders and tactical experts on combat rescue in the United States Air Force, Colonel Russell Bones Cook, the commander of the 347th Rescue Group at Moody Air Force Base, Georgia. We're talking CSAR and so much more on this episode of the Air Minded Podcast.
This is the Air Minded Podcast.
Welcome, listeners, and thanks again for tuning into the Air Minded Podcast. I'm your host, Tyson Gorilla Wetzel. I'm switching things up a little bit for the next couple of weeks. I'm moving away from talking air power history, which has been the focus of all the episodes so far, and we're going to be talking a little bit about air power employment for the next couple of episodes. I have a couple of interviews upcoming with people that I find really interesting, some of the more interesting air power practitioners that I know and that I think you'll find out there. I also wanted to lay out the plan for upcoming episodes. I'm going to move away after these couple of episodes on air power employment to talk some air power historical personalities, including Benjamin Folloy, who I consider the grandfather of the United States Air Force, and then a multi-episode arc talking the history and also debating the legacy, the positives and negatives of John Boyd. I've been getting a lot of requests to talk John Boyd, so I'm bringing it to you. Then I'm going to have a couple of World War II focus episodes before I start my first dedicated season, which I'm really excited about. At the end of this spring, we're going to be focusing on the mecca of the United States Air Force tactical employment in a series that I call Nellis Air Force Base, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. We're going to talk the weapons school. We will talk Red Flag. We'll talk the aggressors. We'll talk Constant Peg. We'll talk the Thunderbirds. If it has happened at Nellis Air Force Base or it is happening at Nellis Air Force Base, I'm hoping to talk about it this spring and into summer in that season. But back to this episode, I had a great conversation with Colonel Bones Cook, who I've known for nearly a decade. Bones is a cerebral officer and leader, and that will come through in the interview. I had him on to talk combat rescue, but we delved into a lot. Agile combat employment, the stress of continued deployments on Air Force equipment, people, families. We talked leadership. We talked professional reading. You name it, we talked about it. And a couple of times I just sat back and let Bones get rolling. And once he was rolling, he had a lot to say, and it was all great stuff. I think you're going to see his passion for the mission of combat rescue and the airmen that he commands just clearly come through throughout the interview. The hour I talked to Bones, it just flew by, and I hope you enjoy listening to our conversation on CSAR and much more as I enjoyed actually recording it. You're going to hear a couple of Zoom issues. You're going to get sort of that metallic sound from Bones. That's my fault. That's a hazard of recording in a snowstorm. It was Snowmageddon last week when I had Bones on. He and I got a little bit, for lack of a better term, military jargony. So there's a couple of acronyms that we use. Let me just give you a primer on some of the terms, and there's a few that we use that we don't define. So I'll give them to you now. PK, probability of kill. NVGs, I think most probably know. That's night vision goggles. He talks about the rescue triad, and that is a couple of weapon systems, three weapon systems that work together as the rescue triad. It's called the HH-60 Pavehawk helicopter. That's what we typically think about I typically think about for combat search and rescue. But there's also the HC-130. It is an air-to-air refueling platform and so much more for this particular mission set. It's one variant of the venerable Hercules series of aircraft. And then the Guardian Angel, and Bones talks about it as GA quite a bit. And this is actually our pararescue jumpers, or PJs, that actually are picking up folks off of the ground and bringing them up typically in the helicopter. Bones, when he's talking about deployments, we'll talk about ISUs, and that's just an internal slingable unit. Doesn't even seem like that's a real term, but that's actually it. And the ISU is just a container that we pack stuff up in when we go deploy. And so when we're using that, we're talking about being able to rapidly deploy. He talks about a forward operating base, also talks about a FARP, or forward aerial refueling point. We talk about General Brown, who is the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, or CSAF. He is the top uniform officer in the United States Air Force. And then we talk about the Combat Air Forces, or CAF. Whew, that was a few of them. Sorry about that. I didn't want to interrupt them as we were going, but I think it will all make sense as we go through it. That said, enough of me talking. You're going to want to hear from Bones. So I will get into the conversation with Colonel Bones Cook right now. All right, my guest today is an incredibly accomplished helicopter pilot and leader, U.S. Air Force Colonel Russell Bones Cook. Has flown multiple aircraft in his career, primarily the UH-1N Dual Huey and the HH-60G Pavehawk. He's a 2000 graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. He's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, where he was also an instructor and a director of operations for the 34th Weapons Squadron. He's graduated from the Marine Corps Command and Staff College, the School of Advanced Air and Space Power Studies, as well as the National War College. He's commanded two squadrons, the 563rd Operations Support Squadron at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Arizona, and also a deployed squadron, the 83rd Expeditionary Rescue Squadron at Bagram Air Base, Afghanistan. He's currently the commander of the 347th Rescue Group at Moody Air Force Base, Georgia. He's a command pilot with more than 2,700 hours, including 250 combat hours. Bones, a little bit of a big intro. Sorry about that, but you're a pretty accomplished dude. So welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
I appreciate it, man. I'm glad to be here and a fan of the podcast. I'm happy to see that you've got this podcast out there, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, I definitely appreciate that, and you are kind of the target audience. So I always start with a couple of questions. While we were talking earlier, it looked like you had like a big gulp. What do you have that you're over there drinking?
So look, I said I was a fan of the podcast, so I'll prove it. Yeah, I do have my Diet Pepsi in my Taco Bell cup there, but I got some Booker's ready nice. To go. All right. Glass gifted to me by the one friend of mine from the 123rd Fighter Squad in nice. Portland, Oregon. So drinking a Helmy, retired there recently, and I wanted to make sure I was ready to go for that question.
All right. Well, I've got a Gentleman Jack and Coke Zero, which is my go-to. I've been straying from that from a couple episodes, but back to it. My second question is, and this can be broadly defined, however you want to answer it. What is your Air Force origin story? You can take us as far as you want, but certainly, you know, what started you at the Air Force Academy, and how did you end up a helicopter pilot in the United States Air Force?
Yeah, you started off your podcast with Jaeger, and like a lot of folks, that was one of the first books I read as a kid and got me interested in flying. So I knew I wanted to fly and be in the Air Force. What got me to the Air Force Academy was I didn't have no money for college. You know, I was building animal cages in South Louisiana and needed a way to go to college, and the Air Force Academy was truly free. So I was very happy to go there, and I felt that was the easiest path into flying. Combat rescue was kind of it took me a while to kind of find that. I knew I wanted to fly helicopters. I kind of liked the idea of being low level and kind of being in the fight. It was a little bit different time then. Special operations was really the only war going on. This is the, you know, late 90s, and that seemed to be where it was at. And so that was where my focus was. I wound up going out and flying DV airlift in Japan, and my heart just wasn't in it. And I had signed paperwork to get out of the Air Force. And then an opportunity came along to deploy to Iraq and to join combat rescue. And I haven't looked back since. It's definitely a family. It's a different type of folks. They're warfighter mentality. They've been at war definitely for the last 20 years, but you could argue since 91. And it's a great community to be part of. And I'm just happy to be in it.
Well, I definitely want to talk just a minute about combat rescue, but the deployment to Iraq, you said you had an opportunity. It was actually in combat rescue, or was it something as like an air liaison officer? What'd you do in Iraq, that first deployment?
Yeah, the first deployment, I was an Iraq advisor, which was kind of a weird fallout. Special operations at the time was doing Iraq advisory, and they would have an augmentee. So I went out there to be an augmentee to the 6th Special Ops Squadron. They left before I got there. And so when I showed up, it was myself and two Army guys and an Italian logistics officer running the Iraqi Air Force on the helicopter side at Taji. One of the best experiences of my life, though. Lived with the Iraqis out there and got an opportunity to fly the Huey in combat. These were Vietnam era, literally Hueys, and got to fly it into Baghdad and do some stuff there. And it was an incredible experience. And then that gave me the opportunity to switch over to combat rescue. It was difficult being a VIP pilot. I couldn't really get to the top of the list to transition. But once I got the opportunity to deploy, all of a sudden I was the only Huey pilot with combat time. So it got me into rescue. And that's kind of how that door opened for me.
All right, so I wanted to talk about the mission set itself. Combat Search and Rescue, or CSAR, as I'm sure I will probably reference it a couple of times. I've heard an A-10 pilot say once that CAS, or Combat Air Support, is the heart of an A-10 pilot, but the soul of an A-10 pilot is Combat Search and Rescue. And there's something about the combat rescue mission that really appeals to some individuals and just kind of grabs them as an incredibly important mission and something that is worth taking huge risks for. So let's just start kind of big picture. What does combat rescue mean to you, and why is it a mission that you've dedicated your career to?
Yeah, one of the neat things about it is no matter what's going on in the world, combat rescue, it's always righteous, right? At the end of the day, you're just bringing someone home, whoever that is, whether it's an American or coalition or partner. And I've even brought, you know, our nation's enemies home. You're bringing somebody home, and that'll always stick in you, and what that means to the person that you bring home. And you do get to see some real effects of what you do in combat. And, you know, that's kind of encapsulated in that rescue motto, these things we do that others may live. And at the heart of that, you create a community around people who want to do that, who want to run out. And if you're rescuing somebody, odds are it's a real bad day. And the enemy is there too. And so it opens up another avenue. You know, the Air Force is filled with, people say they're not, but really it's almost all type A personalities who are highly competitive. And combat search and rescue, it's the ultimate of competition. You're going against the enemy who's trying to prevent you from doing what you're trying to do. And so you're directly pitted against them, and the results are real. And they mean a lot to obviously the person you're rescuing. And then the family, you know, to be on a team with men and women who are going to run out that door no matter what. You know, rescue, the hardest thing is trying to hold them back. If you've ever heard Johnny Bravo, you know, when he was doing Simon Sinek, I Start With Why, one of his big, you know, things in the book is talking about trying to hold rescue back. They're a hard group of folks to hold back, and you're rarely successful in doing that. And that's what makes them so good at their job. So both the mission and the people who are drawn to that mission, it's just truly incredible. And once you get it and it's in your blood, and that's what you see on the A-10 on the Sandy side too, they've been our partners since Vietnam in this mission set. And there's nothing better than having an A-10 out there who's going to come down in the dirt with you and get in the fight. So that is a great community part of it. It's hard to even consider walking away from something like that.
Yeah. Well, possible foreshadowing, General Jolly has said that he's coming on the podcast. So we're bringing him on in the Nellis season to talk all things A-10, being the 57th Wing Commander. And of course, some of the great things that he's done in his career. And I know CSAR will come up as well. So you hit on a lot, and definitely I want to talk about some of the things that you brought up. So you talk about combat rescue being kind of the ultimate competition, as the adversary is out there to prevent you from doing this. And I'm sure their biggest goal is to bring down a helicopter and put more people on the ground. So without sounding too cheesy, what is the most kind of intense rescue that you've had in your career that just kind of stands out as maybe one of those, when you leave, you kind of get scared, like, whoa, wow, what did we just do there in your time?
Yeah. There's a couple, and again, this kind of gets to what makes this job so fun. There's so many different elements that are difficult. The environment itself, you know, being from the web school, you're probably well familiar with the saying, the ground has a PK of one. But when you're raging 50 feet off the ground, you know, that enemy is out there at all times. We live in night. That's typically where we fly. You know, about 66% of our training sorties are done at night, so that we can kind of own that mission set at night. So the environment is certainly a difficult part of that. And that's probably, when I look back on the rescue sorties, it's actually one that I didn't shoot back on. And I've gotten a couple of shootouts in my career, but the one that was the most intense. And then afterwards is one of those moments where, you know, you take the MVGs off and you take a pause. It was in Iraq, and we were going into a support a soft team, a British soft team in Tikrit. They had gotten into a bad spot, and they got into a bad spot when the weather was what we call mission weather. It was about a quarter mile viz, zero illume, and nobody was flying. They had an AC-130 overhead that would shoot in the blind off coordinates that they were given. And it had gone bad for them. And there was about 13 people that needed to get out of there and needed to get out of there fast. So we did as we do. We launched out there, and we did station keeping off of DME. And just, you know, the first 30 minutes of getting out there was just trying not to crash into the ground when you couldn't see anything. It was so dark that when we got on scene to check in, the only way I could rejoin with my wingman was to have them turn on their overt lights, their bright lights in the middle of the night over the city, because at a 0.1 nautical mile, I couldn't see
them. And I guess turning your lights on in combat, not something you want to do over to create a rock.
Not a normal tactic. It was one of those things where we're rejoining and I know he should be there. And then finally, like, hey, you got to turn your lights on. And then he turned his lights on. I was able to see him. And the lights went off pretty quickly after that, obviously. But, you know, and then that was just the start of it. We go in to pull folks out. And our actual LZ, it was in the middle of the city. It was in the middle of the crib. The actual LZ was a building that the AC-130 had just taken out right before. So now we got to figure out a way to land two helicopters into what was a building only shortly before. It's got pipes and tubes and toilets and things sticking up that you're trying to dodge. And as you're going in, the sand's kicking up. And then once you get in the zone, the confusion that comes with a team and trying to get the folks loaded. The part I remember is we had these little armor wings on the side of our seat. And if you could see me from the outside, all you would probably see is two little MVGs sitting over those armor wings as I crouched back behind them, just waiting for any, you know, rounds from any number of the buildings coming up. So we pulled 13 off that site and got them to a medical facility just north of us. And then, you know, I took my goggles off and we're in the FARP getting gas. And that's when you realize what just happened, right? And how close you were to something catastrophic. And then that's when the call came back that they had three more that we had to go back and go get. And that's probably the hardest moment in combat when you've gone through some of that, had an opportunity to stop and think. And now you have to not just take yourself, but lead your crew, your, in my case, the PJ team back into and say, hey, we're going back. And all the things that means, not only is it still dangerous, the enemy definitely knows what you're doing and where you're going and those types of things. And so we never actually shot that night. There's plenty of shooting going on. We never actually shot that night, but the ground, the environment and the situation is something I'll never forget. And definitely was a heart raising moment.
Good Lord. So just one question. Did you leave the 13 British soft guys, you leave them at the forward aerial refueling point and go out to get the next three? You didn't bring them back in, did you?
No. So we left them there. There was a medical facility there. We left them there, and it was actually a mix of soft and then local nationals too, that had gotten, it was a high value target and they were family members or cousins or whatever, the high value target, and they needed medical treatment. So we brought them back as well. We went back and picked up the remainder, which those were two soft forces and one military working dog, which, you know, I've seen a lot in my career, and seeing a dog that's been shot is oddly deeply, it hits you in a different way. And so seeing a military working dog in a gurney is a tough thing. So we get them back to that medical site, and then four or five of them needed to be moved to higher medical care. So by that time, the sun was starting to come up and we were up to a half mile viz. So at that point we were old hands at flying that weather. So it's kind of an easy day flying back. That was a long day. One of the longer missions I've done. I think it was like an 8 or 9 hour one. I've had one that ran a little over 12 hours. Those can be draining days and there's not much left to you after that.
Good Lord. Well, that was kind of what I was looking for by asking that question. The combat rescue guys and gals do amazing work and fantastic story. So there's a few kind of avenues that I wanted to continue going down. They may not all kind of follow one after the other. So they may sound a little tangential, but let me first start with, you are a graduate of the HH-60 course at the Air Force Weapons School. And a lot of us were both graduates of the non-fighter courses, but a lot of folks still think of the weapons school as the fighter weapons school. What kind of role does the HH-60 as a member of the weapons school play? And I know combat rescue has continued to increase. There's more courses now. So kind of what do you think of your experience at the weapons school and the way that combat rescue is treated at the weapons school?
Well, let me start with this. So going through the weapons school, Diz Haid, who I think you know, is a close friend of mine, and she was going through the same time I was going. And so I would, I'd go stop by the intel vault and say goodnight to Diz pretty much every night, and then come in the morning and say hello to Diz every morning because she was in there after me and got there before me.
Yeah, no crew I'll rest you, in the intel course. No crew
that's
rest
right. Yeah. I'll tell you, the intel weapons school is easily the toughest weapon school in that building. And there's no way I could have graduated from that program. So it is an impressive program, and it creates very impressive leaders and tactical leaders who are capable of a broad range of things. And that's what we get out of the 34th Weapon Squadron, which has both HH-60s and HC-130s, and coming soon, enlisted as well, who will go through an advanced instructor course there. We create tactical leaders, and I want to emphasize the leader part. When you're talking about where the Air Force is going, anytime we're trying to make change, and we're in the middle of a lot of change right now, anytime we're trying to make change, I look around the room and try to find my weapons officers right away, regardless of what flavor they come in. One of my best leaders I have right now is an intel weapons officer, Gamble Wilson, out here at Moody. Just really impressive. And what you get at the weapons school, the Air Force has a problem right around the operational level right now. So we talk about the weapons school being an advanced tactics school and developing leaders, and that's certainly true. And then every other service, if you go to advanced studies, they teach the operational level of war. And then the Air Force, we just kind of skip it and we send you a SAS, go, all right, now you're a strategist, with not a lot of middle there. The weapons school is the only place where we've got operational level leaders, folks who understand how we do force packaging, folks who understand what we're going to have to do through the different phases of a combat operation. And so we get these leaders who are very broad as well as having depth in their particular weapon system, but broad across what the Air Force does. They're the only ones that know the family business, is probably another way to put it. As far as culture and the weapons school, yeah, the fighter weapons school thing is still there to a certain extent. I'll tell you, one of the biggest fights is staying in the building. And you'll know this too, as the building has gotten bigger and stuff, being in the building versus being outside the building and the geographically separated units, there's always a little bit of rivalry there, those type of things. But across the board, there's a reason everybody wants to be at the weapons school, because of what it produces, not because of what it is. It just produces the leaders that we need to make change in the Air Force. And I felt like that from the beginning. I felt trusted. I felt like we had the right commandants and the right leadership in all the squadrons, to make sure that we were more than just a one-trick pony at the weapons school, and took advantage of that. And it's only continued as I've gone, and I try to go back and visit for patch nights and those things as much as possible. It's light years beyond where when I went through in 09, and just making great strides. And as it's gotten bigger, arguably, I think one of the concerns was that we would water down what we do. But again, it's just getting back to that family business and realizing that we do a lot of things and it's complex and you need these leaders. And the more that we can produce that have that depth of knowledge is key. And that's what adding the HC-130 weapon school for rescue has done. I don't spend a lot of time if they're an H-60 weapons officer, HC-130 weapons officer, or intel weapons officer. I'm just looking for those weapons officers to help set that vision and guidance on where we're going. And that is the weapons officers are a national asset for sure. And that school is a national asset in producing exactly what we need all the time. So I can't speak enough about it. Obviously, my heart is there. As a Black border, it means the world to me in that school. And my time there is some of the best times I've ever had in my career.
Yeah. And for the listeners, Black border, so you get a graduate patch when you get through. When you become an instructor, your patch gets a black border on it. So that's what we mean by that. Bones and I were at least had, I think, a year, year and a half of overlap where we were both instructors there. One of my favorite things about being out at the weapons school is you don't have to read about something to research. You know, you want to know about a mission or a platform or a combat capability. You don't read about it. You just go down the hall, right? If I want to know about combat rescue, you guys were right around the corner. If I want to learn about F-22 employment, I got to just walk up the stairs and there's the best F-22 pilots in the world. You know, same thing with combat rescue. You're not going to find people that are more experienced and better at what they do. Then we just go around the corner and then you go across the hall, you got the best A-10 pilot. So yeah, there's a lot to be said for the weapons school. I think we both feel the same way. And we'll have a couple episodes on that in the Nellis season. I may have to clip some of this for that one as well. Let me talk about your time deployed as a squadron commander of an expeditionary rescue squadron. So I think there's a level of understanding of risk, certainly when you go and you deploy as a member of a unit, you know what you're doing. There's a whole different weight when you lead an organization into combat, because you're not just taking risks on behalf of yourself, you're taking risks on behalf of your entire unit. Talk me through what it felt like to lead a rescue squadron that obviously just part of the business takes a lot of risk, knowing that, you know, your number one job is to try and bring everybody home, but that is certainly no guarantee. What was it like leading an expeditionary rescue squadron?
Yeah, that was a pretty unique time for me. And I definitely learned a lot of lessons there and cemented other things that I kind of thought along the way. So the way this kind of set up is I was actually the operational support squadron commander, and I got selected to go deploy as a squadron commander. And so I was at Davis-Monthan, and my 60s came from Nellis, and my Guardian Angel team came from DM. And so, one of the things General Brown's talking about right now is that you don't want the team to meet in combat. And that was the same feeling I had there, is I want that team to gel. And so we went at that pre-deployment training in a heavy way. We put up tents, put ourselves out in a deployed environment, and actually took an opportunity to hire a company to come in and give us adversary support and all those pieces, to include the intel support and bring in all those support elements in there as well. And I wanted, the best way to say it is I wanted us, because there's tribes, there's always tribes, no matter what you do. GA and 60s, they're gonna be tribal. And then you have a rescue tribe, and then you have a fighter tribe. So you have all these different tribes. So how do you get folks together and get them on the same page? And you need them to, for lack of a better term, I need the fist fights to happen in the tent at Davis-Monthan and not in the tent in Afghanistan. And going to Afghanistan at the time, there wasn't a lot of rescue forces in theater. And it's a big country, and there's jets flying all over the place. There's special operations going on all over the place. I knew that we would have to be able to move around theater in a very agile way. And I knew that I would need folks who could do every kind of job. I needed AFE troops that could set up comm antennas. I needed them to be able to run an op center. I needed to be able to trust a team to go out with the 60 guys and a few maintainers and get things done. And so we really beat that up at home, and it paid off in huge dividends when we got in theater. And all those things came to fruition. We wind up forward deploying multiple times when I was there operating out of basically one ISU. I'd push one ISU forward and go, all right, let's everything we need to do to be plugged in and have the C2 nodes that we need to be ready to go. Let's get that going. So developing that team first was one of the critical elements. And I went with a really small team by design. I cherry picked, to be honest. As an operations support squadron commander, I had the opportunity to go, okay, here's my two operator. You know, I got my GA operators, got my 60 operators. I'm going to pick my intel. I'm going to pick my medical. I'm going to pick my aircrew flight equipment folks. So I went small and then just cherry picked the best folks I could get. And that made a difference. That support element made a difference in combat and allowed us to be very agile. And, one of the feedbacks I got as I was walking, as I was leaving theater from some great leaders who are still in the Air Force today, so I won't mention their names, but their thought was like, we're not sure that Bones has ever seen a plan that he didn't like. We ran around theater and we were pitching con ops and stuff all the time, but that team enabled that, and I could do that. And you couldn't do that with any team. It was a very special group of folks. While we were out there, we forward deployed. We worked with the Afghan military quite a bit. We did some proof of concept on how to use conventional assets to do deep rescue in Afghanistan. It got at some new things and kind of set the stage for what became a later focus, which is how do you take our GA teams and put them on joint platforms to allow increased capability for personnel recovery in theater. And that's where GA actually started flying on Army Chinooks. And they're out there today flying on Army Chinooks as the 60s have left theater due to risk levels and available forces. And so we were able to get
just to be clear. We know GA Guardian Angels are pararescue jumper teams that that go out there and pick up the folks. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt, but just in case folks didn't know.
Yeah, and so we were able to kind of do some new things that went up gaining traction over time and kind of became the way we do stuff. To include, you know, on we were out there. This was 2016, so we were on the 15th. Year anniversary of September 11th when I was out there. And so we knew, you know, as you could expect, and it would be no surprise that the base would get extra attention on September 11th. And we're sitting out there, you go, you know, I've got these aircraft, I've got these guns, let's go show presence. And for about 72 hours, we showed presence and it worked. And we were able to combine with the Army forces that were out there and combine with the Apaches that were out there. So we were able to take the force that we had and react to the environment that we were in. And that's the thing that the two things that stuck me. One, get your team ready. And exactly like General Brown's pushing today, you have to meet before the fight. You got to get that team. You got to get the blocking and tackling figured out so that when you get in theater, that's all done. However you want to look at it, the storming and norming. Yeah. Now you're going at what is the theater need? What capability do I have? And what do I match it to? My number one lesson from combat is you don't know what's going to be asked of you. Once you get in combat, the enemy gets that vote and you have the team you have is the team you have. So my whole career, I was told, hey, rescue will never do this. Rescue will never do this. I can tell you, I've done every single thing anyone's told me that rescue will never do. And so that goes at that piece of, man, walk in the door with the team ready to go and then an open mind to what you're going to do in theater and then communicate. You know, how do you communicate? How do you get GO level buy-in if you're going to go raging around September 11th with guns hanging, looking for bad guys? You're going to have to be able to communicate that out to leadership and say, hey, this is why this is smart. This, at the end of the day, there's risk here, but it's a valued and purpose. And those were big lessons I learned then. And those were lessons I'd learned previously as a rescue detachment commander where I'd made a lot of mistakes not communicating up. And trying to go and do those things and not finding ways to convince leadership that these things are smart and dealing with the ramifications on the backside that weren't exactly on the up. And fortunately, I was lucky to have a lot of great leaders and many of your weapons. Trashman Hicks was one of them. He was my group commander. I was a detachment commander. And there's not a day that somebody doesn't run into him or I don't see him. And he doesn't remind me of the mistakes I made as a young 04 trying to be similar in Afghanistan in 2010. So a lot of lessons learned there. A
lot of good lessons. As you were talking, especially about getting the team ready, it kind of struck me, this is three episodes in a row now, and certainly didn't mean to talk about this, that where we talk about the preparation of a team for combat. We had Cluso Tolini, the weapons officer of the 58th Tactical Fighter Squadron, talking about getting his guys ready to go to Desert Storm. We had Colonel Mark Cooter and Alec Bierbauer talking about their team, their Predator team, their Air Force and CIA joint team that with very little guidance and just a bunch of, you know, go-getters went out and deployed that platform forward to go out terrorist hunting, including going after bin Laden. And you get the same lessons kind of when it comes to combat, there's some things that doesn't really matter what your combat specialty is, what you fly, whether you fly or not, is you got to get the team ready. You got to be agile when you get there. One of the other things you talked about that kind of led into a question I was already going to talk about was agile combat employment, which is something that's kind of a buzz phrase. It's so hot right now about around the Air Force. What, you know, we talked previously and you said you're ready to talk agile combat employment. What is agile combat employment kind of as a mission set? Where does the HH-60 fit in and why do you think it is important for the Air Force to get behind that kind of concept?
Yeah, well, if you're not frustrated with the conversation on Agile Combat Employment and Lead Wing, you haven't been paying attention. I have a stack I keep on my desk when we talk about this, and briefings I have from ACC in October of 2020 are already outdated. You know, it's already kind of passed. But largely, you know, it's really a DoD concept that the Air Force has adopted an element of it. And so when you look at peer competition and what we've been doing in CENTCOM, we've been falling in on bases that just kind of exist, right? It took a while to build them up. They're there now, and we kind of fall in on them. When we look at our locations around there, they're all sitting under large missile bays, and they're pre-targeted and all these types of things. So if you're going to be able to get in the theater and conduct operations at a theater, you're going to have to be able to employ from multiple locations. It can't be the six FOBs that you have in all of Indo-PACOM. It can't be the 15 UCOM bases. You're going to have to be able to move around theater and do things a little differently. On our piece in combat rescue, that's kind of always been at the heart of who we are anyway. So ACE, it slides right in pretty easily. You know, helicopters fly out of anywhere. And we're as comfortable operating out of a tent. In fact, I'd argue a lot of times more comfortable operating out of a tent forward, which is where we want to be. We want to be as close to the fight as we can get. And that's what you're doing kind of with ACE too. How do I turn multiple sorties? How do I stay close to the fight? How do I generate enough sorties to create the combat power I need before you even get to combat to ensure that we're a deterrent effect that the enemy knows or adversaries know that you're not going to be able to deny those combat effects. And so that's probably a kind of a soft answer to that. And as we kind of dug in what that means, it doesn't mean we're still back and forth as an Air Force on exactly how this looks. And obviously our PACAF and safety commanders, they have votes on what they expect this to look like too. So we are probably coming out of it now, but still really largely in the experimental phase, which is neat. In my career, I've never seen the Air Force be in an experimental phase. So we're trying new things. You know, we'll have an exercise here next week at Moody, where we're going to try new things, operating at forward locations, operating at contingency locations. How can we turn jets? How can we use the forces and capabilities that we have to create as much combat power in a highly contested environment, whether it's denied through cyber and trying to cut into the systems that are so critical for our logistics and supply chains, or something that's more kinetic, you know, just striking a base and trying to crater a runway so that you can't turn jets out of there. And then how do you handle that, that piece? So all that is to say is I don't know what the answer looks like yet. I do know that we're not built for it necessarily. And so, something that I've been trying to explain to folks is we need to get out there and fail in our exercises so we know where we need to go. And to be comfortable with that. And that's been interesting watching the Air Force try to figure out a way to be comfortable with failure, especially in an exercise, right? In an exercise, you got to get that SAT or excellent. That's what you're going for. And I couldn't, one, we won't have a SAT or we won't even effective or excellent. None of that stuff will matter. What matters is the after action report, and the follow on actions. How do we make changes off of what we learned trying these things? So with rescue specifically, and then we're talking about that peer competition. That's the other thing that is hard to do. You know, rescue has been on a 1-2 dwell in a VO or violent extremist operations for 20 years. We're locked in on one theater because that's where all of our pre-deployment training, everything comes. So we're a little bit in a bit of a break glass moment with rescue. At the same time, I still have to keep up those CENTCOM deployments and that focus when it's necessary. But I have to take the opportunity when we're not doing that to go, okay, let's look at these two strategic competitors and see how we fit in their theater. And the answer is we've got a long way to go to be where we want to be. Yeah, can we operate in those theaters right now? Absolutely. But can we be a lot better? Without question. And so that's where our focus is at in combat rescue. We're trying to help define what the risk is going to be in theaters over the next couple of months. This is kind of my focus as General Brown and the CSAP is looking at all these things too at the same time. So my intent is to make sure that we're honest and truthful about what we can and can't do in these peer environments, what we can do with our joint partners, what we can do with our coalition partners, our allies who have different capabilities. you know, the mission set is going to be a large AO, a huge AO, if you're working against a peer competitor who can cause trouble in lots of different parts of the AO. So you have to be able to cover a large AO. And then some parts of that AO, AO being area of operations, some parts of those AOs are going to be just extremely denied and dense. One of the things, though, what's great about rescue and A-10s and attack and a lot of jets, physics are still physics. You really can't innovate around physics. And so things that we do like low altitude flight and train masking and all those elements, that gives the enemy a real trouble piece. And they have to find a way to target and do those things around us. So that's where we're focused at right now. We don't have the answers necessarily. We kind of think we know what the answers are going to be, but we're going to put some hard thought to it and put our crews to the test. And we're breaking glass here. We're going to focus on those theaters, and we're going to start training those distances and threat systems and those type of things. So it'll be interesting. It's a fun time, depending on how you feel about the word fun. It's a fun time to be in the Air Force and trying new things and trying to do a pivot. When you have a CSAP who walks in and says, "Hey, accelerate change or lose them. I want to go fast." That's a clear message in the first 30 days that I've never seen in my career. And looking forward to seeing where we go.
Man, a lot to unpack there. Just read you were talking about the Indo-Pacific theater. They're just doing an exercise right now, an agile combat employment exercise, where they're using the austere base on the north side of Guam. They're putting fighters out of there to just kind of test. I mean, big picture, we can't just put our aircraft at, you know, 6 or 8 bases in the Pacific theater if we're going to be fighting a big war against a peer competitor out there and expect those bases to not be attacked. So we got to be pretty agile. Of course, hitting on the not afraid to fail, and I had on my notes here, and then you just went and hit it, the accelerate change or lose guidance from General Brown. I've had the opportunity to work for General Brown a couple of times. Right guy to be leading this force, and is one that is going to be moving for his 4 years. He's going to be moving fast and is willing to allow us to fail as long as we're learning and getting better. I think the force is going to be in a better place in 4 years when General Brown hands off the guidon to somebody else.
No question.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now there's the ultimate get for this podcast, to try to get General Brown on here, but let's build it up a little bit more first. But okay. So you hit on combat rescue against a peer competitor. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, and you hit on it a little bit with the tactics and tradecraft that you're talking about, but we are, per our national defense strategy, looking at least China and Russia as a competitor. That doesn't mean that we think that conflict with them is inevitable. We certainly have to plan for it. And what I'm concerned with in the area of combat rescue is, you know, do our pilots who are flying in the Baltic across from Kaliningrad or the Taiwan Strait or the Spratly Islands, you know, are they going to be able to rely on what they've relied on for generations, which is if they have to hop out of the jet, that there is going to be a rescue force that's going to go to get them? You kind of talked about it a little bit, but what does combat rescue look like in a world of a near peer competitor who's got a lot of weapons that can be very, very dangerous to our air crew and, of course, our rescue forces?
Yeah, it's going to remain a critical element. There's a couple of pieces here that I'll talk to. One is making sure that we're ready and full up. And I will tell you right now, we're not good enough right now. And if anyone in the Air Force thinks they're good enough for this fight, I would tell them that they need to go back and check their data. We're not good enough right now. And so our job is to get better at that specific fight. We have a test that is starting to become the bones test. But, you know, the other thing, too, if you look at the two theaters, Indo-PACOM is the one that, without question, that we're probably the weakest at. And here's the test that I used internally to get to the point where, like, okay, it's time to break glass and we have to really focus. If I asked you, you know, I 40 years of Cold War and 20 years of EEO, if I asked you, hey, give me a Russian frontline fighter, give me a Russian main infantry vehicle, give me a Russian primary helicopter, I'd get, 70 to 90% answers from most of those. Then I just flipped around and said, hey, now do it for China. Look, most of the answers I got were things people saw on Facebook. So we definitely have to focus on these enemies and their tactics and their weapon systems. And that's what we're trying to break out, what we would expect them to do. you know, 20 years of EO has a negative impact, but also has a positive impact, is that we have the most combat ready aviators in the world, without question. They have the experiences, they have the knowledge and confidence to be able to look at this problem set and go find the solutions for it. So to get to your point, what does combat rescue look like? It's a small force right now. We've been living on a 1-2 dwell. We have to really focus that force on the very tip of the spear, if you will, those high risk areas that we can ensure that we maximize the recovery from, and then utilize the joint force for that medium contestant to low to permissible contested environment. We have some capability of moving our Guardian Angel, our pararescue guys around, put them on joint assets, to put them on our coalition partner assets who do have some capability, but they're not going to have that capability, that long range, high intensity fight. There's not a lot of folks in DOD who can do that. And Air Force Rescue is certainly one of the few. We do have a new aircraft coming online that will help us with this. So one was HC-130J, which is still relatively new. Look, when we start exercising this HC-130J with our other fellow lead wings, it's going to blow minds. I had an opportunity to talk to a few commanders recently about it and talk about this is where this thing is going. It's a CAF asset. It's a Combat Air Forces asset. It comes with that, a Combat Air Forces mentality. And we've been training our folks to be more of a C2 capable platform. They're able to run packages and pick out targets. You know, you got a radar system that can pick out maritime targets on that aircraft. You have an ISR platform that has as good as an MQ-9 sensor. It has a refuel capability for multiple types of aircraft, not just HA-60s. It can refuel itself in theater. I can airdrop. So you talk about ACE, I can resupply. I can do those things. It's a gateway player. It's on the link. And so I can be a node when maybe the other nodes are down. You talk about a contested environment and a player that, oh, by the way, is completely comfortable flying at 300 feet. That's going to be an amazing impact and effect, even in the fifth gen fight. On the HH-60 side, we're transitioning for right now. The 41st Rescue Squadron, the rescue squadron that's in my group, is now standing down the G models, the older G models, and they're standing up the Whiskey. And we have five of them on base right now. And so it's our job to get this thing combat ready with the goal of next summer. And we have a long way to go. There's a lot of things going on. The jet has enormous potential, but it isn't there yet. And so we're working through that. It's still in developmental tests. At the same time, we're doing operational tests. At the same time, we're training crews on it. So we're doing everything we can to get this jet out fast. It is a fully, you know, we use the word fourth and a half gen, a little bit tongue in cheek, but fairly true, right? Obviously not stealth. However, its ability on the link as a player is going to be without peer. Just because of nature, we have to be able to fight high altitude threats and low altitude threats. There's no other CAF player that's going to be able to detect what that Whiskey can detect. And it goes without a person in the loop, it goes out on the net. And so it's going to be pushing a lot of information out there in that enormous potential in its survivability of the aircraft. Some elements are already well beyond the G. Some of the elements will be there as we do the first set of mods that come in the next couple of years. So you throw that asset out there too, which is going to do a lot. And then the Guardian Angel one. That's one we don't talk about enough. We haven't really looked at what a Guardian Angel weapon system can do away from an HH-60. With the HC-130, if it employs independently with them or with some other asset. Again, when you talk about that large AO piece, how do you cover a large AO with only a handful of these high-end capable helicopters and HC-130s? And the answer is through your joint force and through your partner. Well, how do you turn a joint force and a partner force into a combat rescue capable asset? A Guardian Angel team goes a long way to do that. They're plugged into command and control. They understand the mission set. They can help with all those elements that you need to do to execute. That's going to open up a lot of opportunities in an Indo-PACOM-like theater that's large. And it's going to allow you to keep those high-end assets, which, you know, the HH-60 Whiskey and the HC-130J that you really need to be able to push out into that fifth-gen area. It's going to keep them on the front leaning rest on the toes there and that first part of the spear while we're able to cover the rest of the AO. So that's what I think you're going to see. That's where you're going to see a lot of us go over the next couple of years and how we're going to develop that capability. We still have to prove it, right? It's one thing to say it, but rhetoric has to match reality. And so we have to go out there and prove it. And we got to train our air crew to be able to do that. And what that looks like in the ACE concept is you're not flying from runways. You're flying from a middle school, right? And that's, you're as far forward as possible. And so one of the things I think that's lost in the Indo-PACOM UCOM is, you know, this isn't about Moscow and Shanghai. Nobody's talking about those areas. This is about defending the global commons and defending our allies and our partners. That's a home field advantage that we have. And so when we talk about ACE and be able to move around with theater, we're moving around with partners and allies. This isn't a giant HESCO barrier bases that we had to build in Afghanistan because we had so few partners in the area. This is a very different type of combat. And this is a home field advantage I think we can take advantage of. And I could push a HH-60 team as far forward as possible. You know, they're operating on that middle school on the west coast of the Philippines. They're operating on middle school, you know, in eastern Ukraine. That's where they're flying out of because the support system is there with our partners. And that changes a lot of the things. You talk about time to do recovery. You talk about what you need to have forward and what that footprint's going to look like. It reduces a lot of that. So that's where our focus is at. And I think that's what you're going to see in this high-end fight.
So I've been doing a lot of study on Desert Storm, just finished those podcasts. And I looked a lot at what happened between Vietnam and Desert Storm that made us so much different, right? From unsuccessful employment in a lot of ways in Vietnam, didn't mean there weren't little pockets of excellence, to an overwhelmingly successful force. And I really thought it was, I think it's the convergence of a lot of things is modernization, recapitalization of the force, its new thinking, employment tactics, and its realistic training. What you're talking about is the same kinds of things that I think is happening across the Air Force. We're recapitalizing the combat rescue force with HH-60 Whiskey, with the HE-130 Juliet, new tactics and employment, thinking differently about how we're going to do our mission, and then going out and doing realistic training. When you do that, you're going to get yourself ready. And certainly the National Defense Strategy has challenged all mission sets to be better, to be ready to fight if the nation calls. You know, of course, we're going to hope that the nation doesn't call on us to fight those conflicts, but we have to be ready. A lot of times when people think about that, they're thinking the B-2 or the soon-to-be B-21 and the F-22 and F-35, but every combat capability needs to be thinking in that kind of fifth-gen mindset. And it's great to hear you talk about how combat rescue is thinking about that next generation of fighting, whether it is the massive Indo-Pacific theater or it's the UCOM theater or whatever. You did hit on one thing that is a concern for me with the combat rescue forces and really kind of with the Air Force writ large, which is that we have been burning our force out for a while. Forces are not supposed to be deployed in combat for 20 plus years. It burns out equipment, it burns out people, and it burns out families. How combat rescue is a high demand, low density asset, whether you're talking about the helicopters or the refueling aircraft, or you're talking about the pararescue jumpers. How does combat rescue keep the health of the fleet, the health of the people, and the health of their families, so that they're going to be ready to go when you're on such a short dwell at home time versus deployed?
Yeah. Yeah. This is DOD's biggest problem right now, I think. And there's been a lot of great articles, especially from the spouses lately, getting at this. I don't think DOD understands how much talent, you know, as an enterprise, we don't understand how much talent we've lost. It's really not quantifiable, and we don't try to, right? We don't try to, you know, for all the stratification we do, I've never once seen, oh, the Air Force lost 20% of its top 10% in the last 5 years. I've never seen us even try to, you know, figure out where we've lost our talent. But just, you know, notionally, I know who left, and we lost a lot of good talent. So all that is to say is, you know, it has to be a priority to keep talent. You know, one of my favorite memes going around right now is a picture of Tom Brady and Gronkowski. And this is a lesson to the Patriots about keeping talent. You lose talent, it has a cost. And I don't know, when you're not in that peer conflict, I don't know if it's obvious what that cost is at. So for my part, number one, I have to accept we're lost a lot of talent, and we don't make changes, we will continue to lose a lot of talent. And if we're going to get to that peer fight, we're going to have to find out ways to save it. So as leaders and as commanders, it start by the time. There's nothing, you know, can't affect pay. So what can I affect? I can affect time. One of the jokes I used to make about being a commander is that the only thing I can actually have authority over is leave. So I will just approve every leave you ever send me. And if you leave in the middle of an exercise, well, that's a great mentoring opportunity for somebody else to learn about what to do. Getting back time to airmen is absolutely critical. And so how do you create white space? That's going to be different for everybody. For us in rescue, one of the things that I've tried to instill is we waste a lot of time checking work. And if we would just spend a little bit more time just trusting that the younger folks have got it going on and they're doing just fine and time on our vision and where we're going and stay in our lanes as leaders, I think we would get a lot of white space back right there. The other thing that we have to do, and COVID has done a great job of this, hopefully we're learning the lesson of teleworking and being agile about how, you know, get away from this 9-to-5 type idea. And I don't care. You know, I have in my whole office of 8 folks in the group, I just need somebody that can answer the phone from 8 to 4. I don't care who it is. It could be me, just someone that can answer the phone from 8 to 4. Other than that, the only thing I care about is tasks that are prioritized. We're going to have 20. I can do 5, make sure that we're real clear about what are the 5 that are important, and then create the agility for everyone to work around those tasks to do their family. If we didn't cut how much people worked, if we just gave them agility to go, I need to leave at 3 to go take my son or daughter T-ball, that would have a tremendous impact on folks. It gives them the time that they need to prioritize their family and their life, whatever it is. It doesn't have to just be their family, their life, and the things that they do. So I really think the key is, one, accepting the fact that we're losing talent fast, and we have to make changes. And then 2 is give folks their time back, create white space while you can. And that comes with taking risk and trusting and just assuming that things are good, which is not something the Air Force does really well. And then letting them be agile, letting opportunities to do teams or work from home and teleworking, all those things that make things better, and not giving an eye to somebody who's leaving at 3, instead kind of praising it. Hey, look, you know, Airman Snuffy's heading out to go take his daughter to T-ball. That's awesome. And I want to see more of that. The easiest way is commanders need to stop turning in use or lose. Right? Commanders need to take leave, and they need everyone to see them take leave. And when they take leave, they need to go on leave. They don't, you know, you don't need to be seeing emails. They just need to disappear off the grid. It's a great grooming opportunity for somebody else. Let them learn what you do, and set that example. And I think if we get leaders who set the example, prioritize family, and are not working from 6 to 9 o'clock at night every night, that'll go a long way, and we'll be able to keep the talent we want because the mission's there. It's the only reason we'll be able to keep talent is because the mission's there and the people are great.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to hit on. We have you guys
kind of thrown
work them. Your guys have such a sense of accomplishment with the mission that you can still put a lot on them. You know, you mentioned T-ball. I was the executive officer for the commandant of the weapons school for a while, Shark Garland. And I'll never forget one day he came in and he gave me his son's Little League schedule. And he said, I don't care what you schedule me for, but you will not schedule me for anything during these times. And that was a great leadership lesson for me. So Shark made a priority that there were these things that I couldn't, that was white space that I could not infringe upon. Now having a 16-month-old of my own that I had while I was in squadron command, gives you a little bit of an idea. And I'll tell you, when I was, you know, when Amanda was about to have the kid, I was like, all right, well, I was telling my director of operations, I'm still going to come in for staff meeting. Pretty much as soon as I saw Tyson Jr., I was like, okay, that idea is out the window. This is a good grooming opportunity. You take the squadron for a month while I'm on paternity leave. And it was awesome. And then telework. Yeah. I hope we're learning that lesson from COVID. I was just in a snow day and I worked the whole day. So the downside of that is snow days are not fun anymore because you just work the whole time. I did not get off email the whole day. A lot of really good stuff there. I love the idea of trying to quantify the talent that we've lost, and boy, we have lost a lot of talent. Those guys and gals that you're just like, man, they should have been our squadron, our group, our wing commanders, and they left because of the decisions that we as a service have made and not really prioritizing. And it is good to see that we have a lot of leaders in place that are making, at all levels of command, at all echelons, that are making that a priority. And again, you know, I put a lot of faith in the chiefs of staffs that we've had for the last few. Yeah. And I really believe General Brown is of the same mindset. We've already kind of right at that 1 hour point. So as long as I really wanted to take you, but at least one last question. This is the Air Minded podcast, and we talk about all things air minded. You went to what I would argue is the world's premier air and space power institution of higher learning, the School of Advanced Air and Space Power Studies, or SAS, at Maxwell. For those of you who are not familiar, it's known as the Book a Day Club. You read a book a day to create strategists, an unbelievable course. So give us some things, Bones, that you took out of your year at SAS. You're getting kicked in the shins for a year and reading a book a day. What are things that, whether it be air power history, employment, personalities, what are some things that don't get enough run? Who knows, maybe we're talking fertile ground here for future air-minded podcasts, but things that you learned at SAS that you don't think the air-minded folks that we know enough about.
Well, you know, I'll tell you that the number one thing I learned at SAS was to read. and you know, there's that great Jim Mattis article where he sent the email about, look, man, read, go, you know, other people have learned the hard lessons, go learn what you can from those hard lessons. You know, before SAS, yeah, I read, but it wasn't like now. Right. So I come out of SAS and it, you know, there's three books over here. There's two books, you know, by my bedroom. There's books spread all over. I'm reading four books at any one time. Whatever grabs me that day, I'm reading part of it. But holistically, what that does, it gives you time and space to think. And I think that's starting to come out too. As leaders, if you're going to work 6 to 9, when are you stopping to think about where the organization is going? When are you taking the time? And if you're going to be, man, and I hate these words, but if you're going to be innovative or creative or any of those type of things, if you're going to set a vision on where you're going to go, you're going to need space and time to think. Reading does that. Reading does that. You see other people's experiences and you learn from them. One of the best books I just read recently, and I don't know if you've read it, was I've never seen anyone push this book, is Global Mission by Hap Arnold.
Actually have it.
You can get a first run copy. I've never heard anyone push this book. Amazing book. From the, you know, day one, I picked it up. The story of why I picked it up is kind of long, but day one I picked it up. I mean, the first 200 pages are amazing. The last 200 pages kind of dog trash. I think Hap Arnold's got tired of writing. He just started copying out of his journal. But you know, in the first 100 pages, you know, he's flying with the Wright brothers. Doolittle is doing stupid stuff out in the hangar. Like, it's, you know, that part's just amazing for the Air Force history. Then you get to a period going into World War II where he is a real strategist. And we talk about what strategy is and what strategy isn't. You know, I defy you to read that book and I go, oh, that's strategy. You're talking about total number of jets, what kind of jets we're making, how many does the Navy gets, what does the Air Force get? And that, for me, and I wound up giving that book to all my commanders. That for me opened up, just reading that first 200 pages opened up all kinds of new thoughts and where, what we should do and who we should be and where we should go. So that's the part that I would say, go out there and read and find what you read. I know there's a couple of SAS grads that'll push fiction. I'm not a fiction reader, but for them, it's fiction. Science fiction specifically helps open up their minds and lets them see and think of problems in new ways. But all that creates space and time to think. SAS did that. If you remember, we had those study carrels at SAS. It's a cubicle that's as big as your chair, but it's yours. And you're in there by yourself and you're reading and you're taking your little notes or whatever. And that was time and space to think. And I used to keep a separate notebook in there for when I get an opportunity to get back and rescue. Here are things that I think are important. And I'll go back and look at that notebook, and it's largely influenced about whatever I was reading at that moment in time. But in that moment, I was able to create time and space. And as the Air Force has grown, I felt like I've been able to grow with it through that, being able to think through what we're going, as opposed to just trying to chase the Air Force to kind of move at pace with threats. And all that comes from reading and taking some time. And that's what I learned from SAS. that's what I would say that leaders don't do enough of. Take some space and time to think and use the lessons from the past. Look, if you don't like reading, go watch YouTube. There's some great YouTube videos out there.
Yeah.
You know, go get a audio book for your driving to work. There's any number of ways, and I use reading any number of ways in multimedia, but create that space and thinking and learn from the experiences of others.
Yeah. Boy, I feel the same way. I'm a huge reader. I also track my books every year to see kind of what I'm reading. And I like, that is what I give away, for, you know, awards and whatever. And you find books that appeal to you in different ways. My book of 2019 was an autobiography by Bob Iger, who's the Disney CEO. I believe the book was called Ride of a Lifetime. And it was awesome. It was a great, great leadership book. And I gave that to a couple of leaders that work for me. And you can find inspiration in a lot of different places. But you should be looking for that inspiration. You should be looking at people who've done this. And that's what kind of Jim Mattis got at was, you know, if you're learning hard lessons yourself, then you've just completely missed the boat, because somebody's already learned those lessons, right?
Yeah.
Make other mistakes. Don't make mistakes that somebody else has figured out. So that's interesting. The Hap Arnold one is good. I actually have Brigadier General Martimucci is going to come on here in a couple of weeks and talk about Benjamin Folloy, another one of the guys who trained with the Wright brothers early on in his career. His book is called From the Wright Brothers to the Astronauts, which really sums up his whole career. So that's going to be one to kind of shed some light on an air power leader that people don't really know a whole lot about. So, well, Bones, I've taken you for longer than I anticipated, which of course that happens every time. I'm a talker and you know, so are you. So last chance, any saved rounds, anything else that you've got for me or the listeners?
No, man, I appreciate it. I love the podcast. I told you, you know, before that I'm a huge fan of the podcast. It's great to see this out there. It's great to have an opportunity for folks to talk and just share ideas. And that's hard to do. It's probably one of the hardest things to do is to get out of your functional area or whatever and talk to other folks. So I appreciate the opportunity. I love listening. I'm looking forward to hearing more podcasts in the future, bud.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bones. It's been fun. Have a good one. Well, that does it for this episode of the Air Minded Podcast. I hope you enjoyed my discussion on combat rescue with Colonel Russell Bones Cook. I'd love to hear what you think about this interview. You can hit me up on the website, airmindedpodcast.com, or email me directly at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com. I'm also active on social media as @airmindedpod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. I hope you'll subscribe and rate or review the podcast on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are mine alone, and in this case, Colonel Russell Bones Cook, and they do not reflect the official policy or position of the United States government, the Department of Defense, or the United States Air Force. Thanks for tuning into the Air Minded Podcast. I'm the Air Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off. Until next time.